That's a great way to come to order, isn't it? So how many of you were here yesterday? Good many of you. My habit is to begin a class by asking whether you had anything left over from yesterday that you wanted to talk about or ask about. Just take for a few minutes of that. I'm sure you've thought of nothing since we were together last. Yes. Commoditization, reducing everything to a commodity that can be bought and sold and traded and owned. On the one hand, that has to do with consumerism. On the other hand, it has to do with market scramble for stocks and bonds. They're both commodities. And what happens in a commodity narrative is that everything, including other people and including my body, becomes a commodity. A couple of us were talking yesterday about the rage of cosmetic surgery. I would say that's commoditization of the human body. And I would say that minimum wage for people who can't earn enough to live a life is the commoditization of cheap labor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what happens, I'm going to talk about the neighborhood, what happens is that all neighborly values get eliminated. And the church, I don't know whether it's true in churches of Christ, but the church is always tempted to reduce things in the church commoditization, and to run it like a business, and so on. Okay?
Come back at you with a follow-up question.
Yep.
I heard an amazing statistic the other day. The number of people living under $1 a day
that the number of people living in the world on less than $1 a day is now 20% of what it was in 1975,
yeah.
And it's attributed to markets and
yeah.
supply and demand. Yeah. So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
What do you think?
It's good.
You think it's good?
I think it's good, but my fear is that, that there's a lot of commoditization that goes along with that.
Of course there is. You know, when one family controls as much wealth in our society as the bottom 30%, something's not right.
Yeah.
And now that family is spending all of its money on private schools to destroy the public school system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, take one other comment.
If it had an impact, it didn't seem to have a very lasting impact.
I think it has had a lasting impact. 9/11 has had a lasting impact in which it has revved up the level of anxiety in our culture and therefore the level of greed and therefore the level of violence. I don't think there's a direct line from 9/11 to the epidemic of guns. I think they're connected. I think we sense ourselves to be a society under threat, and we act it out in all kinds of ways. The gun epidemic being one of the most dangerous, obviously. But it also has to do, this broad anxiety has to do with the war on the poor. Andy, my conservative friend with whom I have lunch, we never have lunch, but he doesn't have to deliver a riff on the undeserving poor that are takers. He never mentions the agricultural lobby. He never mentions the oil industry. He never mentions the auto industry. But goddamn the poor. You know what I mean? It's everywhere. Yeah, well, you get to decide how intimate. I treat that connection to 9/11 as a symbolic issue. I'm not trying to argue a direct cause and effect, but a new sense of our situation in the world. Yeah. I'll take one other comment. Nobody. You. Yeah. Obviously, Ezra and Nehemiah work from the Sinai Covenant. You can see what begins to happen with Ezra and Nehemiah then is that they want to put the wagons in a circle and become quite exclusionary over the people who do not keep the Torah, whatever. So I think you can make the case then that when you get to Romans and Galatians, Paul appeals to the Abraham covenant, which he calls the gospel beforehand, which is an opening against that. So I just think it ebbs and flows, and when you go too far in one direction, then probably over time you get the reassertion of the other one. So I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to argue that 2nd and 3rd Isaiah, I think, are very much in the Abrahamic tradition, and you can argue then that Ezra and Nehemiah are a response and a reaction to that. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
The other point here that I thought of is that
if you read the Psalms and even the prophets, I would say the Torah is a great good gift of God.
Yes.
And as part of the covenant, right? Psalm 119, for example, cited with reference to you. So the Torah can be seen as a legal code that oppresses.
That's correct.
But that's not the basic line or theme of covenant, I don't think, about Torah.
That's right. But it becomes that. My thesis is it becomes that if it is not informed and corrected by the Abrahamic conviction that God makes promises. So it's an endless act. I think it is an endless act of interpretive negotiation. That's what I think. Which, as I finished yesterday by saying, it tells against all firm settlements that it always has to be done again another way. And I basically live among liberal Christians, some of whom are my best friends, but they tend to arrive at a settlement that is as hard as any settlement that any conservative Christian arrives at. And I don't think it's meritorious either way. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about this thesis that the Sinai covenant organizes social power. We'll get this triad: social power, social access, and social goods for the sake of a healthy neighborhood. So covenant is a commitment to the well-being of the other. And if the other is perceived as a threat or as a competitor or as a liability, so the poor just want food stamps, that's a liability. The reach of covenant transposes others who are threat, competitor, or liability into neighbors, into members of the ordered community, who as members of the ordered community are assured the resources, the security, and the valorization of the community. That's my thesis. So the Sinai covenant is an attempt to regulate things in neighborly ways. And the word for that, as you will know in Hebrew, the word neighbor is rah, which sometimes is translated brother in a patriarchal society that uses masculine language. So neighbors or brothers or companions are those who share the reach and the guarantees of covenantal fidelity. That is, first of all, a reach of God, who is a neighborhood-forming God, but then the reach of all the neighbors toward other neighbors, and particularly the reach of the well-off neighbors toward the less-off neighbors. There is a portrait of such a person in Psalm 112. He is called a righteous man. And if you read that down, what is clear about being a righteous man does not mean that he doesn't drink and gamble and smoke. He probably doesn't and he probably shouldn't, but that's not what it says. What it says is he practices justice in the neighborhood. And he is unflappable when the market varies, because his life is not defined by the market. Except he's not yielded to commoditization. That's what this psalm says is the righteous man. So I want to walk through this narrative contestation about neighborliness, and I will begin by talking about the anti-neighborly narrative that continues to recur in the life of the world. It is a narrative that is organized against neighborliness, I suppose most recently given articulation by Margaret Thatcher, who famously said there is no such thing as society. There is only the market. And all of the attempts at privatization, now featuring the Koch brothers particularly, all of that is committed to the idea that there is no such thing as society, so you privatize everything, and there is no such thing as neighborliness. So what this ideology wants to do is to suck neighborliness out of the economy. No, I want to tell you that anti-neighborly narrative that you know very well. The key character is Pharaoh. Pharaoh, you may know that historical critics have used a lot of ink trying to figure out who Pharaoh is. It may be Ramses, or it may be Merneptah, or someone else by the same name. That's a joke. But Pharaoh is a paradigmatic figure who keeps reappearing in the Bible. So Pharaoh might be Tiglath-Pileser, he might be Nebuchadnezzar, he might be Antiochus IV, he might be Nero, and you can continue the list of people who want to monopolize power and monopolize imagination. So these are the features of the Pharaoh anti-neighborly narrative. First, he had plenty. So in Genesis 12, when Abraham has famine, he knows what to do. He goes to Egypt. Pharaoh has a food supply. Second, this Pharaoh who has plenty has a strange anxiety about scarcity. Isn't it strange that the people who have the most are most anxious about running out? It works that way. So in Genesis 41, he has a nightmare. He has two nightmares. He had two nightmares about seven cows eating seven cows and seven shocks of grain. And he can't figure it out. And his whole intelligence community can't figure out what the nightmare is about. So he has to find a Jew. Jews, long before Sigmund Freud, were good at dreams. And the reason they're good at dreams is that Jews are always edged to the outside so that they must live a double life, partly in the daylight of Gentiles and partly at night when everybody's guard is down. So Joseph doesn't have any trouble interpreting the dream. He says, oh, you had a dream about scarcity. You had a nightmare about scarcity. And then Joseph forgets who he is. He forgets he's a Hebrew. And he signs on as Pharaoh's food czar. Joseph's work is to accumulate more food for Pharaoh. So, plenty, anxiety, scarcity, accumulation. And in a text that we never read in my kind of a church, I don't know whether you ever read it in your kind of a church, in Genesis 47, when the famine came, the peasants came, and Joseph sold them food because he had a lot to sell. The second year they came for food, they didn't have any money. So he took their cattle, he took their means of production and put them out of business and gave them food. Didn't occur to him to give them food. That'd be food stamps. Third year they came for food. He said, well, you don't have any money. You don't have any livestock. I don't know what to do. What do you got? What commodity can you offer me? And they said, take our bodies and take our lands and make us slaves. See, when we read the book of Exodus, we don't often ask, how'd they get the slavery? They got the slavery because of Pharaoh's anti-neighborly narrative. So what you get is plenty, anxiety, scarcity, accumulation. And the end of the paragraph says, so Pharaoh owned all the land. What you get is monopoly. Except the land of the priests, because you need some holy people to bless it. And then if you turn two pages, you will arrive at Exodus 1. And what it says in the first paragraph is that Pharaoh treated the Hebrew slaves ruthlessly. So this sequence of anxiety, scarcity, accumulation, monopoly, predictably ends in violence. And what Pharaoh accomplishes, according to this narrative, he accomplishes a totalism so that there is nothing outside the domain of Pharaoh. There are no social possibilities. There are no goods. Because Pharaoh controls all of the technology, and Pharaoh controls all of the imagination. So nobody is able to imagine outside the zone of Pharaoh's anti-neighborly narrative. Does that sound contemporary? The whole market ideology has now captured the imagination of our society, so there is no space or energy to imagine alternative social organization outside the market ideology of accumulation, monopoly, and violence. And if you ask somebody to do that, they'll say, but they got all the jobs. Or they'll say, I have to pay my mortgage. Or they'll say, I want my kids to go. Well, they'll say all of these sensible things. Because we have arrived at a place of dwelling in such a narrative. Now, what the Bible is about, see if you'll tolerate this generalization. The Bible is about the interruption of the anti-neighborly narrative. And the gospel is the strange conviction that it can be interrupted. And then I would say the work of the church, the work of the preacher, is interruption. And we try to do for that for each other, even though none of us really wants to have that narrative interrupted. So the Exodus narrative is about the interruption. And I'll name five ingredients that I could detect in the interruption. The first ingredient of interruption are these two midwives who refuse to kill the babies. They surreptitiously defy Pharaoh because they know the force is with the Hebrew community. The force is not with Pharaoh. And of course, you know, most remarkably, we know their names. They get 3 minutes of fame. But that's more than Pharaoh gets. We don't know Pharaoh's name. Why would you want to know Pharaoh's name? Because if you've seen one Pharaoh, you've seen all Pharaohs, because all Pharaohs act the same way with the story of accumulation, monopoly, and violence. Second interruption, at the end of Exodus, or near the end of Exodus 2, Moses, in his profound indignation, killed an Egyptian foreman who was abusing a Hebrew slave. And I think what we have to look at is that right at the core of the story of emancipation, there is an act of violence. I don't know, well, it's reactive violence against the violence of Pharaoh. And I don't know what to make of that violence. I don't think we can cover it up or pretend it's not there. But the learning that I would draw from it is there will be no interruption of the narrative of anti-neighborliness unless there is abrasiveness. How far the abrasiveness goes is a tactical question. But every liberation movement I ever heard of has got shock troops out front. So civil rights, you didn't have Martin if you wouldn't have had Malcolm. So Nelson Mandela was a part of the National Congress that subscribed to violence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not to condone violence, but it's to be realistic about the grip of the totalizing claim of Pharaoh. Third, at the end of chapter 2, you know how it goes. When Pharaoh died, everything came unglued. And the Hebrew slaves groaned and cried out. This was not the first day they hurt. And Pharaoh did not care that they hurt. What Pharaoh cared about is that they brought their pain to speech. Because when pain is brought to speech, see? Where's that phone? That's bringing pain to speech, no doubt. It turns to energy. And energy becomes interruptive of a narrative that wants nobody to have any emancipatory energy. So the cry begins to mobilize the juices of heaven and earth. And my own suspicion is that part of the task of the church is to bring to speech the pain of people who have been narcoticized by the anti-neighborly narrative. And we don't know what will happen, but we know something will happen if that energy is released. And the fourth thing that happens, so you got the midwives, you got the killing, you got the pain. The fourth thing is that Moses turned aside and saw the burning bush. Now, I think it's amazing that Yahweh does not appear in the narrative until the third chapter. Being nurtured in Augustinian theology, I was taught that God takes all initiatives. But God comes very late to this narrative. There's been a lot going on about interruption, and finally God says, you know, I think I ought to get in on that. So what happens then is that God calls Moses by name, and then God, in rather exaggerated, boisterous fashion, says, I have seen your affliction, I know your hurt, I am paying attention, I will come down, I will deliver you, I will bring you out of the land of slavery, I will take you to a land flowing with milk and honey. And I'm sure he paused at the end of verse 9 and said to Moses, how do you like that? And then in verse 10, fifth, God says to Moses, you go to Pharaoh. I'm not going, you go. So the fifth element is human agency. I think we've emptied the gospel of so much of its human power that we expect to be saved by God. But God says to Moses, if you want to be saved, you got to run some risks. So the risk is to get in the face of the anti-neighborly narrative. And, you know, Moses doesn't want to do it. Moses makes a series of disqualifying excuses about why he can't do this. And Yahweh says, shut up. Go. So the way the book of Exodus sets this up, it seems to me, is that we've got these competing narratives, one of which features Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt, which is the totalizing of cheap labor and commoditization. And the other is the narrative that features Yahweh, Moses, and Aaron, divine resolve and human agency, which is emancipatory and begins to imagine what life would be like outside the totalizing anti-neighbor narrative. And I propose that the preaching and the worship and the prayers and the teaching of the church in this context are to imagine what life is like outside that narrative that seems absolutely comprehensive. I think you can see that in Jesus' parables. What Jesus does is to create scenarios of human possibility that are outside the domain of the Roman Empire and all of its habits of commoditization. So, you know, the two best-known ones about the Good Samaritan and the two prodigal sons are about people who perform their humanness in neighborly ways and to violate all of the conventional expectations of society. And I want to suggest to you that those with whom we minister and we ourselves are endlessly negotiating between these two narratives. We know the power and the attractiveness of the gospel narrative that anticipates a neighborhood. But my pension plan and my medical coverage are in the other narrative. And I don't want to go very far. So I think that the pastoral posture is to know that we are dealing with people who are profoundly torn and ambivalent, as are we, and that this zone of ambivalence is precisely the place where God's Spirit does God's best work. So what happens in the book of Exodus is a contestation between these two narratives. And I think there is nobody that gathers in our churches that do not carry that contestation in their bodies and in their families and in their memories and in their hopes. And I think that the task of preaching is to name the contestation and to help people participate in it knowingly. Because what we know deep in our gut that we don't want to think about is that the narrative of accumulation, monopoly, and violence cannot keep its promises. It cannot make us safe, and it cannot make us happy. And the indices of that are all around us. We are a more insecure society with all of our recent accoutrements of security than we have ever been in human history, I suspect, in the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it is the hard case to make that the alternative narrative of neighborliness is a narrative about how to be safe and how to be happy. You know about how to have a safe neighborhood. It's not by having more police. It's by having more people sit on their front porches talking to their neighbors. That's what makes a neighborhood safe. And that's what makes a neighborhood happy. So you know how the contestation goes. We call it plagues. It's a contest about anything you can do, I can do. And what interests me about that contest is that the first two rounds are a draw. Blood turned to water. They both do that, and they both make frogs or something. It's the third round where the issue comes to light, in which Moses and Aaron make gnats, and Pharaoh's intelligence community, called the magicians, intelligence community. You know, intelligent community. Oh, we didn't see the Soviet Union was going to fall. We didn't know any of these things were going to happen. We just have records and records and records of spies. They couldn't make gnats. Did you know that? Pharaoh's apparatus has reached the end of its technological capacity, from which you can draw the narrative conclusion. You don't need to be afraid of Pharaoh. You don't owe Pharaoh anything. You don't need to obey Pharaoh. You don't need to trust Pharaoh. Pharaoh is finished. There's some mop-up action to take seven more plagues because he's a hard-nosed son of a gun. But he's finished. He's finished early. I preached a Good Friday service on the. I preached seven times on the seven last words of the cross. Do you do that in your church? And one of those is, it is finished. You know, it is finished, the cry of triumph. And I don't know if any of you are old enough basketball fans. This was before the current expose of racism. But do you remember Red Auerbach, who coached the Celtics back in the days when they always won? Well, Red Auerbach had this taunting gesture when he thought he had won. Sometimes as early as the third quarter, he lit up a victory cigar on the bench. Said, hey, we're going to play the rest of the game, but it's over. So what I said in my sermon, to the anguish of some Episcopalians, that it is finished is God's victory cigar. That it's all done. You just have to play the rest of it out. So the gnats episode is Moses' victory cigar. It's all over with.
now. If you can't make gnats, you can't do anything. And then, as you know how that contest ends, finally, in chapter 12, I think it is, isn't it? Where Pharaoh says, after the 10th plague, please leave. Take your flocks, take your herds, take your women, take your children. But before you go, bless me. Extraordinary moment in the history of the world in which the manager of the anti-neighborly narrative acknowledges that the future belongs to the emancipated slaves who are now going to live their life outside of the domain of Pharaoh. And you know how the story goes, and they went to the wilderness. They found out the wilderness means a place not presided over by Pharaoh. And what they found out is that there's bread, meat, and water outside of Pharaoh's domain. I think we have to know the narrative anti-neighborliness and the investments that we have in it. I think we have to think through the vocation of interruption that belongs to God's people. I think we have to be prepared for the knowing participation in the contest. I think we ought every day to be surprised by the discovery that there is food and nourishment and sustenance outside Pharaoh's domain. And then he came to Sinai, and I said to you yesterday that the first thing that's said in chapter 19 is, if you will listen to my voice and keep my covenant, you can be my people. And immediately in 19:8, they said, all that Yahweh commands, we will do. And what I think is so remarkable is that they said it in chapter 19. They said it before the Ten Commandments were given in chapter 20. They said it before they knew what the commandments were. So why did they agree to that before they knew what the commandments were? Well, I think it's obvious. They did that because they figured any commandments by the God of emancipation will be better than the commandments of Pharaoh. So I want to interpret the Ten Commandments. Oh my goodness. I want to interpret the Ten Commandments as counter-Pharaoh commandments that are regulations for the neighborhood. Because Pharaoh's commandments are what? Make more bricks. Make more bricks without straw. Work harder. Shop more. Spend more. Eat more. Get more plastic surgery. Have longer erections. Sorry. But you know those ads now for erection medicine, whatever those initials are, they really now say it's your duty. It's time to man up. Manning up for 4 hours is exhausting. Does anybody in your church ever say, I'm too busy, I'm too tired, I'm too rushed? I saw an amazing thing in the library. I went over there for an hour this afternoon. I saw a student actually reading a book. Most of them are in the library thinking they're studying and they're tweeting. Because you got to stay connected all the time. Pharaoh's world is a 24/7 world. You dare not be disconnected. You dare not take a Sabbath. Because your worth depends upon your demonstration of membership in Pharaoh's anti-neighborly world. So the first commandment, no other gods. You don't owe anything, to the gods of Pharaoh. The second commandment is, don't count on any commodity, no matter how beautiful and engraved it may be. The fourth commandment is, take a break. Can you imagine a Sabbath in Egypt? I can't even imagine Pharaoh taking it over. I bet he had to check the monitors to make sure the brick production was on schedule. So rest is an act of defiance. And you know how hard it is. You just, well, take a peek at your email. Just a peek. And the 10th commandment, I was taught in ancient days, the 10th commandment is being envious of something that someone has. That's not what it's about. It's about an acquisitive society in which you believe that the purpose of life is to acquire things that belong to others. That's what Pharaoh did. Pharaoh was endlessly confiscatory. I was astonished to find out not long, I read it many times, I never saw it. The 10th commandment, it's just a little thing in verse 17, has the word neighbor in it three times. Patriarchal society, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. But if it's a threat or a competitor or a liability, they're not neighbors. You can covet everything and take it from them. All you have to do is buy a congressman. You can get the laws written so anti-neighborliness is regulated in your favor. So the Ten Commandments are not 10 little rules for moralism. The Ten Commandments are a countervision of what it means for the haves and the have-nots to invest together in the common good. Now, I didn't watch my time very well, so I'm not going to, you'll be glad to know I'm not going to do the whole book of Deuteronomy in 3 minutes. But the book of Deuteronomy, you know, Deuteros, it's not a copy. That's how where we get that word in Deuteronomy 17, the king shall keep a copy of the Torah. It's not a copy. It's a second version. It's a new revised standard version of the Torah. So you get all kinds of things that you didn't get at Sinai. And if you look through it, you will find neighbor, 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 neighbor. So I was looking this morning. I never had seen this till this morning. I did prepare before this morning, but you know. The law on the year of release in Deuteronomy 15, which cancels debts at the end of 6 years, it has the word neighbor in it a whole bunch of times, and it has the phrase members of the community. So you can do anything you want to foreigners, but to everybody who's in the covenant community, who is a neighbor or a brother or a sister, you cannot hold them in hock for economic reasons, because our life is not about economic control. It's about neighborliness in the common good. And then Moses says at the end of it, don't you forget, you were slaves. So what the book of Deuteronomy is about is an attempt to institutionalize the miracle of the Exodus, to form laws and protocols and orders and procedures
for what it means to live in an emancipatory community. So I believe that the greatest decision ever made in the history of the church was the decision made in Acts 15 to admit the Gentiles, to admit people who were a threat, who were unlike us. And the work of the church now is to fight the exclusionary policies and practices of Pharaoh's narrative by opening it. And if I ask, who do we have to open it to? It seems to me the three most likely candidates are immigrants, Muslims, and gays. And we have to negotiate all of that among us. We're not all at the same place about all that, and neither am I. I'm not all at the same place about that. So that it may be that the question that Jesus left at the end of his parable is, who is my neighbor, is the most important evangelical question. The neighbor turns out to be people who are unlike us, who have gifts to give us. But when people are perceived as threats, competitors, or liabilities, we imagine they don't have any gifts to give us. So what I'm wanting to suggest to you is that there are two great paradigms, one of which is profoundly anti-covenantal, and the other narrative onto which we have signed is this incredible narrative of neighborliness in which God reaches out to transpose people into neighbors, to the discovery that the haves and the have-nots have a common interest in the common good, and that there is no private wealth or private happiness or private security. These are all mediated to us through the common good. So this biblical vision of organizing social power, social goods, and social access differently is an incredible mandate and vocation for us. Now, how are we doing on time? Have we got a minute? We don't have a minute. One comment from somebody who wants to say something or ask something. Anybody? Right here. Neighborliness. I don't ever want to get into a debate about capitalism and socialism. That is a defeating discussion. It is about neighborliness, and I don't have any blueprint, but it is not hard to figure out about any public question in front of us what would be a more neighborly policy than a less neighborly policy. And I think it is the litmus test of all workable policy that has to do with housing, with wages, with health care delivery, with education, with anything you can think of. It just makes a difference if the other people around us are neighbors upon whom our well-being in some way depends. And I think we really have to avoid getting sucked in to those theoretical conversations about that. Thank you.